Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers. FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay.
Free the Black Panthers. FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements with black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here. Fuck coins, hell pro.
Show.
They got me started, lying hearted. I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we rise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, if you think this shit won't be televised. Black power, be scared guys, they be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fucking promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here. Fuck coins, hell pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, shit, that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack fucked up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police departments to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prisons. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
All it's my life I had to fight, nigga. All it's my life I hard times like, yeah. Bad trips like, yeah. Nazareth, I'm fucked up, homie, you fucked up. But if God got us, then we gon' be alright.
Nigga, we gon' be alright. Nigga, we gon' be alright. We gon' be alright. Do you hear me? Do you feel me? We gon' be alright. Nigga, we gon' be alright. Huh? We gon' be alright. Nigga, we gon' be alright. Do you hear me? Do you feel me? We gon' be alright.
And when I wake up, I recognize you looking at me for the pay cut. Bahamas, I be looking at you from the face down. One Mac 11, even boom with the face down. Skimming, and let me tell you about my life. Painkillers only put me in the twilight. With pretty pussy and Benjamin is the highlight. Now tell my mama I love her, but this what I like, Lord knows. 20 of them in my Chevy, tell them all to come and get me. Reaping everything I sow, so my karma come in heaven. No preliminary hearings on my record. I'm a motherfucking gangster, in silence for the record. Tell the world I know it's too late. Boys and girls, I think I've gone crazy. Turn inside my face, it's all day. Won't you please? pride was low. Looking at the world like, where do we go? Nigga, and we hate po-po. Wanna kill us dead in the street for sure. Nigga, I'm at the preacher's door. My knees getting weak and my gun might blow. But we gon' be alright.
Nigga, we gon' be alright. Nigga, we gon' be alright. We gon' be alright. Do you hear me? Do you feel me? We gon' be alright. Nigga, we gon' be alright. Huh? We gon' be alright. Nigga, we gon' be alright. Do you hear me? Do you feel me? We gon' be alright.
What you want? You a house, you a car, 40 acres and a mule, a piano, a guitar, anything. See, my name is Lucy. I'm your dog. Motherfucker, you can live at the mall. I can see the evil, I can tell it. I know it's illegal, I don't think about it. I deposit every other zero, thinking of my partner. Put the candy, painting on a Rico, digging in my pocket. In a profit, big enough to feed you. Every day my logic, get another dollar just to keep you in the presence of your chico. Ah! I don't talk about it, be about it. Every day I seek you. If I got it, then you know you got it. Heaven, I can reach you. Pet dog, pet dog, pet dog, my dog, that's all. Pick back and chat, I shut the back for y'all. I rap, I black on tracks, so rest assured. My rights, my wrongs, I write till I'm right with God. When you know, we been hurt, been down before. Nigga, when our pride was low, looking at the world like, where do we go? Nigga, and we hate po-po, wanna kill us dead in the street for sure. Nigga, I'm at the preacher's door. My knees getting weak and my gun might blow, but we gon' be alright.
Nigga, we gon' be alright. Nigga, we gon' be alright. We gon' be alright. Do you hear me? Do you feel me? We gon' be alright. Nigga, we gon' be alright. Huh? We gon' be alright. Nigga, we gon' be alright. Do you hear me? Do you feel me? We gon' be alright.
Nights in my prayers.
I remember you was conflicted.
The first thing a slave must do is admit I'm in bondage. Admit I'm in captivity. Admit that I'm a slave and Giuliani is a slave master. Admit that I'm a slave and Clinton is a slave master. Admit that I'm a slave and Cuomo is a slave master. That's the only way you can get free. Stop walking around acting hip, slick, cute, and cool with Hoochie and Coochie and Poochie and Gucci and all that stuff. You're a slave. You can't wait to get out of here and get a good night's sleep so you can go to your elevator plantation tomorrow. You're a slave. You're a slave to your car note. You're a slave to your rent. You're a slave to your lease. You're a slave to your telephone bill. You're a slave to your light bill, your gas bill. You're a slave.
Dr. Clark. He called for the unity and the redemption of the African world.
Salute them, honorable Marcus
Garvey. We were not ready to listen then.
They might not have been ready then.
There's wonder whether we are ready.
Ain't no doubt about it.
To listen.
We ready, baby.
Now.
Let's go. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Black fly high. Woo! Black fly high. Black fly high. With the side to side, it's the black fly high.
Come on,
a flag fly high, a flag fly high, a flag fly high.
RPGs on the rise, all eyes are recognized.
A flag fly high,
hold it high, let it fly. Reckon colors forever, Garvey will never die. On my 90, the throne ready, let's take a ride. Tax walk, big men don't choose a side. This is the path for the warriors. Seldom travel, yet still bad, glorious. Black power represents us. Do we the rolling with Africa or against us?
Flag fly high, flag fly high, flag fly high.
Black fist in the sky, with the side to side, it's the flag fly high.
Black fly high, black fly high, black fly high.
Black fist in the sky
That teaches you to depend upon another race is a leadership that will enslave you. Any leadership that teaches you to depend upon another race is a leadership that will enslave you. They gave leadership to our foreparents and that leadership made them slaves. But we have decided to find a leadership of our own to make ourselves free men. Our great scholars haven't passed through the colleges and universities have thrown away the blessed record. Babylon did it. Assyria did it. France under Napoleon did it. Germany under Prince von Bismarck did it. England under America under George Washington did it. Africa with 400 million black people can do it. If you cannot do it, if you are not prepared to do it, then you will die. You race of cowards, you race of imbeciles, you race of good for nothing. If you cannot do what other men have done, what other nations have done, what other races have done, then you have better die. Can we do it? We can do it. We shall do it. We pray to God for vision and for leadership. And He has given us our universal vision. A vision that will not limit our possibilities to America. A vision that will not limit our possibilities to the West Indies. But a vision that said it must be a free and redeemed Africa. Christ the crucified, Christ the despised. We appeal to you for help, for succor, for leadership. When you endeavor to carry your burden up the heights of Calvary. When white men spurned you. When white men scorned you, when white men spat upon you, when white men pierced your side out of which blood and water gushed forth, it was a black man in the name of Simon the Syrian who took your cross and bore it up the heights of Calvary. And now that we are bearing our burden of being so heavy, we just ask that you just help us on up the heights. Oh yes, the cause is grand, the cause is glorious. Surely we shall not turn back. Oh, sail on, sail on, sail on, oh mighty ship of state, sail on. Sail on until the flag of the red, the black, and the green is perched upon the hills of Africa. Because the time has come for the black man to forget his hero worship of other races and to create and emulate heroes of his own. We must canonize our own saints, create our own martyrs, and elevate the positions of fame and honor black men and women who have made a distinct contribution to our racial history.
You have the emergence in human society of this thing that's called the state. What is the state? The state is this organized bureaucracy. It is the police department. It is the army, the navy. It is the prison system, the courts, and what have you. This is the state. It is a repressive organization.
But the state and people, well, you know, you've got to have the police, because if there were no police, look at what you'd be doing to yourselves. You'd be killing each other if there were no police. But the reality is, the police become necessary in human society.
So a Molotov cocktail at the precinct, you know how we think. Organize the hood under I Ching banners. Red, black, and green instead of gang bandanas. FBI spying on us through the radio antennas. And I'm hitting cameras in the street like watching society. With no respect for the people's right to privacy. I take a slug for the cause like Huey P. While all you fake niggas try to copy Master P. I wanna be free to live, able to have what I need to live. Bring the power back to the street where the people live. We sick of working for crumbs and filling up the prisons. Dying over money and relying on religion for help. We do for self like ants in a colony. Organize the wealth into a socialist economy. A way of life based off the common need. And all my comrades is ready, we just spreading the seed.
Live a third of his life in a jail cell. But the world is controlled by the white male. And the people don't never get justice. And the women don't never get respected. And the problems don't never get solved. And the jobs don't never pay enough. So the rent always be late. Can you relate?
No more bondage, no more political monsters, no more secret space launches. Government departments started it in the projects, material objects, thousands up in the closets. Could have been invested in the future for my comrades. Battle contacts, primitive weapons out in combat. Many never come back, pretty niggas be running with gas. Rather get shot in they back than fire back. We tired of that, corporations hiring blacks. Denying the facts, exploiting us all over the map. That's why I write the shit I write in my rap. It's documented, I meant it. Every day of the week, I live in it, breathe in it. It's more than just fucking believing it. I'm holding in ones, rolling up my sleeves and shit. It's C-Lo for push-ups now, many headed for one conclusion. Niggas ain't ready for revolution.
The average black male, live a third of his life in a jail cell. Cause the world is controlled by the white male. And the people don't never get justice. And the women don't never get respected. And the problems don't never get solved. And the jobs don't never pay enough. So the rent always be late. Can you relate? We living in a police state.
Time to move with the leadership to buy your own land, to buy your own building, so that nobody can dictate whether a padlock is put on it ever again. Then you don't step forward, but you cheer louder than anybody in the damn audience. You eat more bean pie on the outside. You buy more bean pie than anybody. You got all the tapes at home. You got a library of tapes. Dr. Ben said, Dr. Clark said, Dr. Akbar said, just a constipated Negro. Your brain is constipated. Your heart is backed up. Afraid to stand up. There are enemies among us, and we must find them and get rid of them. It's a shame that Eugene Roberts still lives walking around New York after he's responsible for the murder and the assassination of Malcolm X. But Eugene Roberts is doing interviews on television. He's a goddamn celebrity. Dr. Feld on the front row with Gene Roberts' picture, exposing him. He does interviews now. He's a celebrity. An undercover agent in the OAAU of Malcolm X. Seen in the Audubon Auditorium pretending to give him artificial resuscitation. I'm just telling you what the people are telling me on the streets. The real radical ones. They saying that he should be dead. That's what they're saying. I ain't got nothing to do with it. That's what they say. William O'Neill. But the Panther Party, the agent responsible for the murder of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, the agent that drew up the floor plans, told them where Fred Hampton's bed was, that what angle they had to shoot in order to kill him while he was asleep, still walking the streets today. Because you just want to hear speakers. You just want to wear your African tikis and sandals and dashikis and boobas and crowned and gowned to the ground. And you're red, you're black, and you're green. But when it comes time to stand up and strike a blow for freedom and independence, you ain't nowhere to be found. I got to say it. I got to say it. So during Reconstruction, white men got angry. And they moved on every black elected public official. And here we are, starting all over again. It says the 1965 Voting Rights Act, which resulted in a dramatic increase in the number of black elected officials at the federal, state, and local levels, that from 1965 to 1970, their number increased from 280 to 1,629. But as of 1993, the last year such figures were compiled, there were more than 8,000 black elected public officials. More than 8,000. But the condition of our people is terrible. More than 8,000 black elected public officials, and black people are still in the mud and the filth and the squalor of the white man's world. Poor, ragged, naked, hungry, and out of doors in the white man's world, and over 8,000 black elected public officials. Jesse Jackson now. OG Tom, old Tom, raising up a new Tom, got Jesse Jackson Jr. now, grooming him to be the new Tom, put him in District 2 in Mel Reynolds' place. Instead of standing up for Mel Reynolds, fighting for Mel Reynolds, you say, well, he did wrong, so look what they did with white folks who did the same thing. Some white folks did worse. It's important to understand, brothers and sisters, what we're dealing with here. Donald Buzz Luckins, an Ohio Republican, served 9 days of a 30-day jail term in 1991 for having sex with a 16-year-old black girl. He also was ordered to participate in a program for sex offenders. But the cracker said, he argued that he could not have contributed to the delinquency of this child because she already was unruly, he said, when he had sex with her. Now this is a Republican from Ohio, 30 days in jail and put him in a program. Mel Reynolds, much more than that. Republican Daniel Crane admitted having a sexual affair with a congressional page. His punishment was censure by the House of Representatives. They just talk rough to him. Would the gentleman from Illinois refrain from this kind of conduct? It is not becoming of the high office of the gentleman from Illinois. That's all he got. He had sex at least 4 times with the page, according to a report by the special counsel to the House Ethics Committee. It started after he met the 17-year-old and gave her a 6-pack of beer and betted her on a basketball game. After he met her, he made a bet on a basketball game. And they had a 6-pack of beer. She lost. And he did what he wanted to do. Look at it now. The House Ethics Committee also voted to reprimand Representative Gary Studs for his sexual relationship with a male page. Boy, this boy was way out. Studs, a Massachusetts Democrat, remains in Congress today. The congressional report outlining charges against Studs said he took the page to his apartment in Washington's upper-class Georgetown neighborhood and plied the boy with vodka and cranberry juice until 4 a.m. I'm going to leave that alone. Later, the page went on a two-week trip to Europe with Studs, who also made advances toward other male pages. Former Senator Brock Adams, a Democrat from Washington State, dropped his 1992 re-election bid after 9 women said he sexually harassed them. Representative Barney Frank, a Massachusetts Democrat, remains a popular member of Congress despite his 1989 admission that he paid for homosexual sex earlier. He was officially reprimanded by Congress. Representative Ken Calvert, a California Republican, was easily re-elected 2 years ago, even though a state policeman found him with a prostitute in a car after midnight, and according to a police report, apparently engaging in sexual activity. Police did not charge Calvert with a crime and withheld information about the case until a newspaper sued them. Look at this. When the white folks do it, they let them go. Even the ones that do it with other boys, they let them go. So during Reconstruction, it was hyped, exaggerated charges of corruption that caused them to create the kind of climate for the Knight Riders, the Ku Klux Klan, and other disgruntled, rabid, racist crackers. You know what's happening now? You know the reason Baez is gone? You know the reason we shot down 24 times and the reason the chokehold is applied all across the country and what's the boy's name? Can't we all just get along? Rodney King. It's because in the police department, the FBI, the CIA, ATF, if that's what they are, DEA, all of them, they are now the racist, rabid, racist, cold, white supremacist, the Ku Klux Klan of Reconstruction. All of them now hide behind the shield. As Mark Furman said in words, you can execute a nigger because a policeman is God on the streets, he said. He said when we just see a nigger doing this or that, he talked about how they move on what they call a nigger. Supreme Court Justice, as I near my conclusion, Thurgood Marshall said that the Ku Klux Klan no longer wears white hoods and white robes. They now wear black robes as judges and blue uniforms as policemen. The mentality is pervasive. The mentality is everywhere. Bill Clinton wants this conservative cracker to know that he's going to put niggas in their place. He just does it with a smile. Welfare reform. Fastly, in many states, welfare is becoming farewell. They're making sure to let us know you got to go for self. You got to do something for yourself. We can't carry you any longer, nigga. And so, brothers and sisters, as I near my conclusion, I say to you that this is the year of the bullet or the bullet.
Here we are. Here we are. Here's for the people.
That's dumbest, can't read the language of Egyptian mummies, on a flag or a moon, and can't find food for the starving tummies. Pay no mind to the youth, cause it's not like the future depends on it. But save the animals in the zoo, cause the chimpanzee them a make big money. See the whole media villages, on TV the picture is savages the villages, and the scientists still can't explain the pyramids. Evangelists making a living on the videos of ribs of the little kids, stereotyping the image of the images, and this is what the image is. You buy a coffee pants and all of a sudden you are there in Indiana Jones. And I keep all the gold and keep all the scrolls and even the bird bones. Some of the worst paparazzi I've ever seen and ever known. Put the words on this place that the world can see and it's all that we'll ever show. So the ones in the west will never move east and feel like we'll be at home. Get tricked by the beast but the way them a go flee when the monster is fully grown. Salamonic lineage where them two can defeat and them could have never clown. A spiritual DNA that prints in my soul and I will forever own, Lord.
Yeah. Savali. Patience. What the old folks told me. Can you give us that? Discovering the world before this world. A world buried in time. Uncovered with rhymes. It gets no realer.
We born not knowing, are we born knowing all? We growing wiser, are we just growing tall? Can you read thoughts? Can you read palms? Can you predict the future? Can you see storms coming? The earth was flooded, you went too far, you would fall off. Now the earth is round, if the shape changed again, everybody would have stopped love. The average man can't prove of most of the things that he chooses to seek of. And still run research and find out the root of the truth that they seek of. Galas teach in universities and claim like they're smart and cunning. Tell them find a cure when we sneeze and that's when their nose start running. And the rich get fixed up when we get cut. Wanna heal them broken bones in the bush with the wet mud. Can you read signs? Can you read stars? Can you make peace? Can you fight war? Can you milk cows, even though you drive cars? Can you survive against all odds now?
It's crazy. When you feed people the truth, you don't know how they're gonna react. You're scared of wrongdoers, people that's just ignorant. Scared of the truth. We patient. For now. Who wrote the Bible? Who wrote the Quran? And was it a lightning storm that gave birth to the earth and then dinosaurs were born? Who made up words? Who made up numbers? And what kind of spell is mankind under? Everything on the planet we preserve and can it. Microwave it, try it, no matter what, we'll survive it. What's you? What's man? What's human? Anything along the land we consuming. Eating, deleting, ruin.
trying to get paper. Gotta have land, gotta have acres. So I can sit back like Jack Nicholson, watch niggas play the game like the Lakers. In a world full of 52 fakers, gypsies, seances, mystical prayers. You superstitious, throw salt over your shoulders, make a wish for the day, cuz like somebody got a dollar me. Sticking needles in my artery, but I can't feel it. Sometimes it's like part of me, but I got a real big spirit. I'm fearless, I'm fearless. Don't you try to grab hold of my soul. It's like a military soldier, since 7 years old. I held real dead bodies in my arms, felt their body turn cold. Oh, why are we born in the first place if this is how we gotta go? Stay. To all the wisdom and knowledge seekers of the world. Savali, patience. Yeah.
Well, we want to welcome you to our rally, our unity rally, for a united black front. To unite all factions of our people. To unite every one of the 20 million so-called Negroes into one group. And you'll notice, whenever the white man thinks that we're going to call a rally to knock our own kind, you see him jammed out here. He wants to hear us say something against King or against Bunch or against Farmer, against someone of our own kind. He jams out here. But when you call a rally for black people to unite, let's get together, you don't see too many white folks then. They don't like black people to get together in unity and harmony. As long as you and I are going to attack each other or talk about each other or heap scorn and ridicule upon each other, the white man gets his kick. But when he knows that we're going to come together in unity and harmony, he won't get his kick. He will get kicked. When you see you and I getting together, it is because we have begun to realize that we have a common enemy. And the only time we'll be able to come together with a common objective and a common goal is when we first develop a common motive. And that motive is best developed by recognizing the common enemy. And that common enemy is the white man. I say that common enemy is the white man. The white man is your enemy, whether you are a Baptist, whether you are a Methodist, whether you are a Episcopalian, or whether you're a Muslim, or whether you're a Mason, or whether you're an elk. If you find yourself running into opposition when you're looking for freedom, justice, and equality, or some kind of right, you have to agree, always the one who opposes your right is the white man. Some old blue-eyed, blonde-haired, bad-smelling white man. When he puts his club upside your head, he doesn't care whether you're a Baptist, a Methodist, but he does want to know whether or not you're a Muslim. Because he knows if you're a Baptist or a Methodist, you're going to turn the other cheek. You're going to try and love your enemy. You're going to pray for them that despitefully use you. So he's not worried about you. But he knows if you're a Muslim, you're not going to turn the other cheek. If you pray for him, you pray that God kills him, or God helps you to kill him. That's the only kind of prayer you pray. It's time for you and me to unite, to get together and get this big white ink off our back. You got a bad habit. You're hooked and don't know it. You got what's known as white disease. You think you can't get along without the white man. You think you can't get some clothes without the white man. You think you can't get a house without the white man. You think you can't even get a job without the white man. You're worse than a man who thinks he can't get along without heroin. You're worse than the man who thinks he can't get along without morphine. You're worse than the junkie. You're in worse shape than the junkie because the junkie only has a little monkey on his back and you're running around with a big white ape named Uncle Sam on your back. America is faced with her worst domestic crisis since the Civil War or since the Revolutionary War. For America now faces a race war. A race war is worse than a revolutionary war. A race war is worse than a civil war. A race war is a war in which no holds are barred. A race war is a war in which children are destroyed, in which children are mutilated, in which children face the same destructive wrath that grown-ups face. A race war is the worst war that you can conceive. And this war, race war, that is coming upon the head of the white man is something that he is bringing down upon himself. The entire country is on the verge of erupting into racial violence and bloodshed. Simply because 20 million ex-slaves are demanding freedom, justice, and equality here in America from their former slave master. 20 million so-called Negroes, second-class citizens, seeking human dignity, seeking human rights, seeking the right to live in dignity as a human being. And rather than give genuine respect and recognition to your cry for human rights, the American white man answers your nonviolence with violence. He answers your prayers and your freedom songs with false promises, deceitful maneuvers, and outright bloodshed. According to what we are taught from the white man's textbooks and his school, the Revolutionary War and the Civil War were two wars fought on American soil, supposedly for freedom and democracy. But if these two wars were really for the freedom and human dignity of all men, why are 20 million of our people still confined here in America and enslaved by second-class citizenship? Something is wrong. The truth is that the Revolutionary War was fought on American soil to free the American white man from the English white man. The Revolutionary War was never fought to provide freedom and democracy in this white country for the black man. Our people remained slaves here in America even after the Declaration of Independence was signed. In fact, most of the white founding fathers who signed the Declaration of Independence were nothing but slave owners themselves. It is sheer hypocrisy, sheer ignorance, sheer insanity for our people here in America to celebrate the 4th of July as Independence Day, while white America still denies us first-class citizenship that goes with an independent people. And it is nothing but hypocrisy for the American white man to pretend that the Revolutionary War was truly a war of independence as long as 20 million black people here in America are denied the privileges of an independent people. Don't let the white man fool you. Don't let the white man smile at you and lull you to sleep. Behind that smile is a vicious heart. Behind those teeth is an animal-like beast who doesn't have it within him to want for you what he wants for himself and his own kind. Don't let that man fool you. When you look at that man, you're supposed to see him for exactly what he is. And if you want to know what he is, examine his deeds. Forget his words. He got a whole lot of pretty sounding words. Watch his deeds. His deeds are like the deeds of a snake, the deeds of a serpent, the deeds of a dragon, the deeds of a reptile, the deeds of a beast. Why, nothing but a race of beasts would take dogs and stick them on little black babies. Nothing but a race of beasts will stick dogs on black children and black women. Nothing but a race of beasts. And it is these deeds today that's causing the wrath of God to come down upon the head of the white man. And when you see him as he is and see how much hell he's catching, you're out of his mind to want to be with him. You're out of your mind to want to integrate with him. And you're really out of your mind if you take time to forgive him and ask God to have mercy on him. No, ask God to judge him. Ask God to do unto him as he has done unto you. He has caused your babies to suffer. Ask God to heap suffering upon his babies. He has caused your women to suffer. Ask God to heap suffering on his women. He has caused all of our people to suffer. You can't deny that. You may not like my singing, but you can't deny it. Why, you got scars and knots on your head from the top of your head to the bottom of your feet. And every one of those scars is evidence against the American white man and his inhumanity to man. The Civil War was also fought on this continent, not to free the black slaves, as is commonly taught in the white man's schools, but the Civil War was actually fought to preserve the Union, preserve this country, keep it intact for white people. It wasn't fought to set you free. It wasn't fought to give you some kind of emancipation. It wasn't fought to make you a citizen. It wasn't fought to give you civil rights. It wasn't fought because they respected you and loved you as a human being. It was fought out of greed. It was fought out of selfishness. It was fought to keep this country intact for their own white selves. In essence, this only means that the American white man fought the Revolutionary War to get this country for himself. And he then fought the Civil War to keep this country intact for himself. And today, he will now fight a race war to keep from having to share this white country on an equal basis with anyone else but his white self, especially on an equal basis with his 20 million former slaves. So again, I ask, where will all of these demonstrations end? And who dares to say that our people are not justified by demonstrating their resentment over the injustice and mistreatment that our people have suffered these 400 years at the hands of this cruel, inhuman American white man? We have nothing to lose but our chains. We have nothing to lose but the hell we experience every day living here in these rat-filled slums. You have to excuse me for being blunt speaking and frank talking. We don't care who likes it or not, as long as we know it's the truth. Much of what I say might sound bitter, but it's the truth. Much of what I say might sound like it's stirring up trouble, but it's the truth. Much of what I say might sound like it is hate, but it's the truth. And God has mentioned in the Bible, it's truth alone today that'll make you free. If you're afraid to tell the truth, why, you don't even deserve freedom. Just tell the truth. The best thing to put the white man to flight is truth. He can't take the truth.
Damn it, it was the devil that killed Brother Anthony Baez. God damn it, it was the devil that shot our brother down on the streets of Brooklyn, shot him 24 times. It was devils who killed Brother Yusuf Hawkins. It was devils who were responsible for Eleanor Bumpus. It's devils who killed Jerry Lee Amy and Eula Mae Love. It was devils who brought you here on the slave ships to the hells of North America. You better remind yourself every day. They moved on Mel Reynolds. They moved on all of them. Look what they did in Clinton's Congress. They moved on all of Clinton's people. Did you know that? Clinton had 5 so-called minority appointees. We ain't no minority. We outnumbered this speck of wood 12-1 on the face of the planet Earth. But he had 12 so-called minority appointments. The Clinton administration had these 5. Michael Epps, the black former Secretary of Agriculture, gone. Huh? Ron Brown, Secretary of Commerce. They killed him, but before they killed him, they charged him with misconduct from his office of the Department of Commerce. Huh? Energy Secretary. Huh? Hazel O'Leary. Huh? And a couple of others. What happened during Reconstruction? white folks became angry, the white male. They're talking about an angry white male today. And so the white man's ego got involved. He blocked the entrance. Bishop Henry McNeil Turner, down in Georgia. Bishop Henry McNeil Turner of the AME Church. Policemen lined up in front of the door of Congress and would not let Bishop Henry McNeil Turner go in. And he had been duly elected by the people. We were even governor. Pinchback became governor of Louisiana. But every position we held, the cracker rolled back the hands of the clock. In the twinkling of an eye, when he got ready, he said, no more of this foolishness. A nigger ain't to rule over me. A nigger is not to be a sheriff over me. Nigger sheriffs arresting white folks? Hell no, he said. Give me that badge, nigger, and get back in a nigger's place. Some of you who are undercover agents sitting in the audience, your job is temporary. And if you continue this, your life is temporary. Over a short period of time. Temporary over a short period of time. Temporary anyway, but we mean over a short period of time. You come in among black people and spy on black people. Negro judge on the slave theater. With no more better judgment than that. See his brother persecuted by the criminal justice system that he's been a judge of. He obviously didn't read Bruce Wright. He obviously didn't see what Alton Maddox was doing for black people. And so a Negro boot-licking judge who owned the slave theater, now it sits there with rats and roaches running all over the damn place. But because white folks put pressure on a nigger judge, the nigger judge padlocked the door and told the white folks, I took care of it, boss. I took care of it for you, boss. Did I do a good job, boss? I put him out, boss. Is that a good nigger, boss? They say, well, nigger, we got something else for you to do. White man knows he can't trust you. If your own people can't trust you, the white man knows he can't trust you. So your job is a temporary job. You come and sit in this audience and go and report back to the white man. We see you, nigga. We see you. Your wig is crooked. Your Jerry curl got too much juice in it. We see you. And as this nation gains freedom and independence, and more of this revolutionary spirit rises up in the minds and hearts of the people, we will kill you for coming to betray the legitimate aspirations of our people. Oh, yes, we will. It's the year of the bullet. Are the bullet. But some of you are not willing to pay the price. You want to come here for years and just listen to great speakers. Go home and listen to great tapes. But when it's time to move with the leaders.
Olmec, the first major civilization in America. The dating of the wooden platform, the charcoal, there were 9 samples of charcoal dating, gave a reading of 948 to 680 BC. It's not just the Stonehenge, but in addition to the Stonehenge, you have terracottas that are clay sculptures of African type. Not only the nose now and the...
I got loyalty, got royalty inside my DNA. Cocaine quarter piece, got war and peace inside my DNA. I got power, poison, pain, and joy inside my DNA. I got hustle, no ambition, flow inside my DNA. I was born like this, is born like this, immaculate conception. I transform like this, perform like this, with Yahshua, a new weapon. I don't contemplate, I meditate, then off your fucking head. This that puts the kids to bed. This that I got realness. I just kill shit, cause it's in my DNA. I got millions, I got riches building in my DNA. I got dark, I got evil, that rot inside my DNA. I
just win again, then win again like Wimbledon. I serve, yeah, that's him again. The sound, the engine in is like a bird. You see fireworks and Corvette tires skirt the boulevard. I know how you work, I know just who you are. See, use a bitch, your hormones probably switch inside your DNA. Problem is, all that sucker shit inside your DNA. Daddy probably snitch, heritage inside your DNA. Backbone don't exist, born on side a jellyfish, I gauge. See, my pedigree most definitely don't tolerate the front. Shit I've been through probably offend you, this is Parler's oldest son. I know murder, conviction, burners, boosters, burglars, ballers, dead. Redemption, scholars, fathers, dead. With kids and I wish I was fed. Forgiveness, yeah. Soldier's DNA, born inside the beast. My expertise checked out in second grade. When I was 9, on sale hotel, we didn't have nowhere to stay. At 29, I've been so well, hit cartwheel in my estate. And I'm gon' shine like I'm supposed to. Antisocial, extrovert, and extra lit mean an extra work. And absentness, what the fuck you hurt? And passiveness never struck my nerve. And that's a riff, gonna plead this case. The reason my power's here on earth. Salute the truth and the prophecy. I got loyalty, got royalty inside my DNA.
Discuss the issues in LA, they want to discuss them only within the context of the time that these disturbances occurred. And they only want to discuss them in terms of the images of people running around in the street and destroying property within that context. And one of the things that the ruling groups in this society always seeks to do is to control time, to control the use of time. And by confining then the discussion to the period of time of the disturbance, then the emphasis is on the actual behavior. And therefore the behavior is not placed within historical context, political and ideological context, and therefore is made to appear all the more irrational and purposeless. Often the events that precipitate a so-called riot or a so-called revolt appears to be somewhat minor, you see, and in and of itself not worthy of the kind of reaction that occurred. But this can only appear to be the case when one ignores the prior history of the disturbance, and one ignores the underlying emotional state, social and political and economic conditions that existed at the time of the disturbance. When one forgets then that the apparently minor occasion which precipitated the reactionary disturbance itself may have been symbolic of a particular set of historical circumstances and symbolic of a particular state of mind. Merely the straw that breaks the camel's back. Because as we say in Black on Black Violence, every act has a history. And it's in that history that we come to understand it. And therefore, we must resist the attempts of those on TV who interview us and so forth to confine the discussion to the mere behavior of the people during the time that that behavior occurred. And we ourselves must look at the history that occurred prior to the event, and more importantly, at the state of mind of the people who precipitated the event or were precipitated by events to engage in that behavior. The preconditions which set the stage, for the Los Angeles and urban revolts have a long history and are many. They include both socioeconomic conditions and the collective mental state of the African-American community. Of the two, the mental state of anxiety and frustration over current and future developments, that state is the more important. It's not the concrete state as much as the perception of the state and the state of mind of a people. The dissatisfied state of mind and the attitudes of black people toward our conditions constitute the major factors which precede and underlie urban violence and revolt. So you can't look at the number of people who have achieved middle class status and so forth. You must look at the state of mind of our people and the level of dissatisfactions that exist in our minds as people. The preconditions for the LA revolt, of course, were many. And I'll just name a few of them. We don't have time to go through them all. Some of you might have had a chance to see or read the Atlantic magazine of May 1991. And you see here, of course, the issue of race was its cover story. When the official subject is presidential politics, taxes, welfare, crime, rights, or values, the real subject is race. We have old quail who can't tell the difference between potato and potato talking about traditional values. Another coded word for race, implying that black folk have no values, implying somehow that black mothers and fathers actually tell their children to go out and commit crime. Son, when I want you to grow up, I want you to be the biggest crack dealer on the block. That would just make me so happy. Be a criminal. Drop out of school. You know, what is this man talking about? What is he implying when he tries to imply that there's an absence of so-called values in the black community? Be very suspicious, by the way, of these people who talk about values anyway. We have to ask him, what kind of values did they have to make them rob and steal and destroy the Indians and the enslavement of black people? As I often said about Jimmy Swaggart when he used to talk about that old-time religion. He used to march across that stage with that Bible pumping up and down. Yes, talking about the religion of his great-grandpas and how he wanted that religion brought back. Of course, I have to remind my people, you really don't want that religion brought back. Because at the time they had that religion, they were hanging and lynching black people and enslaving black people. So I definitely don't want that old-time religion. And I'm a little weary about those traditional values he's talking about, too. Because those are apparently the values that underlie the racism of this nation and that rationalizes white supremacy. And that somehow lays the ideological foundations for the mistreatment of African people in America. I am not concerned then about the restoration of their so-called traditional values, but the creation of new values. In this book and in this magazine by Thomas Byrne Edsall and Mary Edsall, they start out the article by stating, race is no longer a straightforward, morally unambiguous force in American politics. Instead, considerations of race are now deeply embedded in the strategy and tactics of politics. In competing concepts of the function and responsibility of government, and in every voter's conceptual structure of moral and partisan identity. We're at the very center and heart of how America defines itself. Race helps define the liberal and conservative ideologies, shapes the presidential coalitions of the Democratic and Republican parties, provides a harsh new dimension to concern over taxes and crime, drives a wedge through alliances of the working classes and the poor, and gives both momentum and vitality to the drive to establish a national majority inclined by income and demography to support policies benefiting the affluent and upper middle class. In terms of policy, race has played a critical role in the creation of a political system that has tolerated, if not supported, the growth of the disparity between rich and poor over the past 15 years. Race-coded images and language changed the course of the 1980, 1984, and 1988 presidential elections, and the 1990 elections for the governorships of California and Alabama, the U.S. Senate in North Carolina, and the post of Texas Secretary of Agriculture. The political role of race is subtle and complex, requiring listening to those whose views are deeply repellent to some and deeply resonant for others. The debate over racial policy has been skewed and distorted by a profound failure to listen. And so we see here then that blacks are the scapegoats of this society. African Americans are the means by which this society defines itself. As I say it again on black violence, you see, that the whole of the white ego and the whole of the white self-image is built on its definition of who black people and African people are. That is why it is obsessed by criminalizing African people. Whenever you see a people insisting against all kinds of evidence on negating and scandalizing the personality of another person or another people, you recognize then that they're engaged in those acts to protect their own ego, and that their ego structure is built on maintaining the scandalizing of their targets. And that if they did not have these targets of scandal, if they did not have these egos, these people as scapegoats, their facade and their infrastructure would crumble and fall apart. They would come face to face with the madness and insanity that motivates their personalities and their systems. When blacks move out of our role as scapegoats and redefine ourselves in ways that cannot be denied by any people in the world, then white people will go crazy. And they will fall apart. And we said in Black on Black then that the so-called criminality of black people is an economic and political necessity for maintaining the system. It is not merely an accusation flowing from racial prejudice, nor merely accusation flowing from racial hatred, as hatred has little to do with it. It is necessary to the very foundations of the system itself. That's why at the center of it, even in the current politics of the day, you will see African people. And how will you deal with African people as the determining factor in terms of who will get elected and who will be given power in this society. It determines who will be called liberal and who will be called conservative. It determines then the support that they will win in this system or will not win. We have a situation here then where the Democratic Party and the dastardly behavior of Clinton is trying to change the perception that the white electorate has of it so that it can gain power by disrespecting black people and by creating bogus issues. And again, it has come to recognize, as is made very clear in this article, which basically lays out a program for the Democratic Party for achieving power in America, by saying you got to learn somehow to disentangle yourself from these black folks. Because in an analysis that you sponsored, a polling firm that you hired found the following. These white Democratic defectors, talking about those, what you call the Reagan Democrats, expressed a profound distaste for blacks, a sentiment that pervades almost everything they think about government and politics. Blacks constitute the explanation for their, white defectors' vulnerability and for almost everything that has gone wrong in their lives. Not being black is what constitutes being middle class. Not living with blacks is what makes a neighborhood a decent place to live. These sentiments have important implications for Democrats, as virtually all progressive symbols and themes have been redefined in racial and pejorative terms. The special status of blacks is perceived by almost all of these individuals as a serious obstacle to their personal advancement. Indeed, discrimination against whites has become a well-assimilated and ready explanation for their status, vulnerability, and failures. So you see why we got to look at more than whether we've gotten an increase in jobs and whether more of us are in schools and so forth, because the attitudes that the other people are operating on have little or nothing to do with these sort of things. You read last week where the whites engaging in the buying of weapons is increasing at a faster rate than blacks. And whites engaging in violence is increasing 30% faster than blacks. And as I will talk a bit later on, this speaks to the fact that whites feel extremely vulnerable. They feel under threat. And this implies then that at some point these feelings may boil over into attacks on the black community. For the rationales have already been set. This situation where the election to political office, where gaining the reins of power depends upon one's relationship and attitude toward blacks, is very serious. It means then that blacks must be subjected to a constant barrage of innuendo and scandal. And that the best way to get over then is by attacking the very integrity and humanity of the black community. And it means then that this attack on the humanity and the integrity of the black community must proceed even at the time when some blacks appear to be making it up in the system. It means that you must even use those blacks who are making it up in the system to join you in the attack on themselves. This is one of the underlying causes. This is one of the preconditions that was there when the LA insurrection occurred. If you read the current Atlantic magazine, which seems to revel in the analysis of African people, they will talk in this current month about the suburban century. They call it the suburban century begins. And what do they mean by that? They're referring to the fact now that the political base of this country lies in the suburban areas. And for the first time in the history of this country, it's the suburbs who carry the weight in terms of votes. It is no longer the large cities which carry the larger percentage of voters. And consequently then, politicians who expect to get elected to office must speak to the suburbs and must cajole those and flatter those who live there. This is why then you're hearing again and again about this neglected middle class, you see, and programs that concern themselves with rehabilitating and restoring the middle class. Another code for we are going to ignore these blacks whom we have locked into these inner cities. And we are not now going to propose any kind of programs for them. We are now going to propose that you're the ones that are in trouble. And we now are going to rescue you from your troubles. You look in many of the publications today talking about edge cities, new cities created principally by whites that ring the inner cities. Cities that now, whose governments are almost under direct control of these white suburbanites. Cities then that have influence in state governments in such a way that they can prevent taxation schemes that are meant to rescue the inner cities, that are meant to change the direction of the miseducation of our children, that are meant to relieve the problems of the inner cities. We have a situation then where whites have organized themselves in such a way that a politician who even talks about the rescue of the cities is literally damned for state office or for higher office. And now you see Clinton and other groups speaking to this suburban fringe. Is this fringe suffering? They tend to think that the black community implicitly or explicitly is not aware of what is going on. Let's look at some of these things, some of these preconditions. By 1991, the federal government's largest housing subsidy program was providing an average of $3,000 a year for each of 6 million wealthiest households in America, while offering nothing to the 36 million Americans in poverty. Only one of every 8 federal benefit dollars actually reaches Americans in poverty. There has been a wholesale rape and robbery of the poor and weak in this country. And yet, this is the class that is supposedly now being rescued and is now supposedly being ministered unto by those who run for office. From 1980 to 1991, in constant dollars, the average federal benefit received by households with incomes under $10,000 declined by 7%. An actual decrease in benefits from the government, but yet we get a lying and deceptive image that because of the fiscal difficulties in this country are those people on welfare, of the burden placed upon the government and upon the treasury by the poor people and by inner city people. And yet these people earning under $10,000 have actually had their monies taken away and not added on to, while the rich and while the middle class have actually fed at the government troughs. On average, households with incomes under $10,000 collected a total of $5,690 in benefits. On average, households with incomes over $100,000 collected $9,280 from the government. In other words, those making over $100,000 collect nearly twice as much from the government as those earning under 10. You see, you'll hear whites in making these discussions and talking about the state of this country and talking about the debt that this country is suffering from. And you can hear them talk about the deficit and the threat that this deficit holds for the health of this nation. And I want to warn you that this nation is in a very precarious state of circumstances. And the precariousness of its state will be made clear after the elections. But if you listen carefully, you can already feel the panic over the concerns of the economic state of this country. They are in such a panic that they know they have to reduce the deficit of this nation if it is to survive and if it is going to be socially viable. In my series on power, I talk about one of the causes of black-on-black violence, other than the psychology that I referred to earlier, other than the social relations, has to do with the economic state of the black community. I try to emphasize that it's very important from a conceptual point of view to think in terms of a nation within a nation when it comes to analyzing black problems. I am not advocating that you buy the concept that we should have a nation within a nation. So don't give me a knee-jerk reaction right on. What I am saying is just think conceptually in terms of black people as a nation within a nation. I think when you use this concept, it will help you to see some things that perhaps you cannot see through the use of other concepts, such as individualism and the other stuff that people lay on you. When you look at the black community and the African-American community in this country as a nation within a nation, it becomes almost immediately apparent as to why there's so much violence and social disorganization in the black community. I often use the Chinese Opium Wars to illustrate what I'm talking about, of how the British, in entering trade with the Chinese, were buying all of their tea from China, and China was buying nothing from the British. The British had nothing the Chinese wanted. And yet the British wanted that tea. They were hooked on a tea habit. And the Chinese demanded only silver and gold from the British. And that meant over time that the British balance of payments became unbalanced because her silver and gold was flowing into China, but nothing, no earnings were coming back from the Chinese. And they were facing a dilemma. They recognized that this situation could not continue, or else they could not maintain their social institutions, and they could not maintain social order in their society, and that their government could not maintain legitimacy, and the people at some point would rise up against it in revolt and refuse to follow its dictates and refuse to pledge allegiance to it and destroy it. Because this is what happens to nations when they have negative flows of wealth. Because it takes wealth to maintain order. It takes wealth to maintain institutions. It takes wealth to maintain employment system. It takes wealth to create jobs. It takes wealth to educate children and so forth. And when that wealth is flowing out into the hands of other people, these institutions collapse. The discipline of the people collapse. The obedience and the habits of obedience collapse, and chaos begins to reign. And the only way governments can maintain power then under those circumstances is often to use martial law and strong martial means of maintaining population control. And that has serious limitations. And the British then recognized that we had to change the situation or else our very society will be destroyed. And what did they do then? They hooked the Chinese into an opium habit and addicted the Chinese and then demanded of the Chinese once they got hooked, now you pay us for your opium in silver and gold. And that habit got to such a level that the balance was reversed and the flow went out of China to England. And when the Chinese tried to stop it, the English government, the old pusher that it is, yes, a government based on drugs. The Queen, the greatest drug pusher the world has ever known, went in like any gangster on these streets out here to protect their monopoly to sell drugs to the Chinese and engaged in two wars to maintain the drug market that they had established. And yet you try to sit here and listen to these jokers with their moral pieties trying to talk to us. Nation built upon the selling of drugs and the government coming in defense of the selling of drugs. But my point here is, of course, what happens when you get trade imbalances. And the Chinese recognize if we don't stop this stuff, our wealth is going to flow out to such a degree until we then will suffer social collapse. Now, when you look then at the African-American communities, surrounded by non-African communities, plagued by economic parasites, coming into its midst and taking its wealth and earnings right out, exploited by white and non-white alike, who rob it of its wealth and rob it of its resources, and who even in its stupidity tries to say the answer to this is to increase the number of us with skills and education, only to have those with increased skills and education also what? Shipped out so that they can solve other people's problems and spend their earnings in other people's markets, and therefore can't return neither their skills nor their wealth back to the original community. So then what do you have? A community, an African nation with a tremendous trade deficit, with a tremendous trade imbalance, with a tremendous outflow of material resources and capital and brain, and an increasing concentration then of people who are bereft of skills and resources and the like. Violence and social disorganization, family and institutional disorganization becomes inevitable under those circumstances. Am I getting across to you? Because I don't want to hear you talking to me when I tell you that you've got to throw these Koreans out of this community, and you've got to throw these Arabs out of this community, and you've got to throw all the rest of these jokers out of this community, come talk to me about some racial harmony and love and reverse racism and hiding under Islam and some Christian ideology. Because you must recognize the hard cold fact is you cannot educate your children. You cannot train them in the way they should go. You cannot give them appropriate recreational centers and other things they need without material wealth. And you can't do it by handing it over to other people. And it is not the result of hard feelings or racial hatred against any other people. It is not reverse racism. It is a matter of survival and protecting your own. I do not want to hear any pompous discussions about values and pompous discussion about how parents should teach their children values. Anybody who's lived in the ghettos as long as I have knows that you can teach values day in and day out and still lose your children. Because we live in a world and in a context where we are not the only one that raise our children. We're not the only ones that influence our children. The middle class isn't better at raising children, and it isn't better at projecting values. It is only better at buying neighborhoods. Because when you buy your house, you buy your neighborhood. You buy your school. You buy a set of neighbors. And you buy a social and political context. That is not just the buying of a house. You buy a totality. And you buy a totality that supports your values. Values are little or no account when they are not reinforced by a social system and rewarded by concrete outcomes. How long can one hold on to a value when one is starved with holding on to that value? When one is punished and rejected? Even when one demonstrates that one has held on to that value. When then we demand that our children exhibit certain values, then we should be in the position to reward their exhibition of those values. Or else we will look as hypocrites and fools, and we will give them empty and pious sayings that in the long run works against their interests and not for their interests. Half, or at least 400 billion, of all entitlements went to households with incomes over $30,000. Do you hear what I'm saying? $400 billion went to people who earned over $30,000. Talk about your pride, your individual pride and your individual drive and how you got your little house as a result of individual drive, even though you ran down to the Federal Housing Authority to back your mortgage and to back your down payments. Even though you have engaged the federal government to insure your mortgages. And you're going to talk about how independent you were in getting your house. How can the poor then go to the federal government and get it to insure their rent and pay out rent and other costs? Now, you got a government behind you even when you think you're buying that house all by yourself. Even when you think you've scraped and saved and put that down payment on it. When you sit up there and deduct those credits, who do you think stands in and pays the tax? You don't pay. When you write so proudly the deductions that you deserve as a homeowner. When those of us who pay rent and other things cannot make the same claims. Do you think that you are being independent? No, you are not. You are feeding from the federal trough. And you are feeding at the rate of billions from the federal trough. And therefore those, one half of all of those entitlements, $400 billion, went to households, $30,000 and above. One quarter, or at least $200 billion, approaching almost the whole earning power of black people went to households with incomes over $50,000. Who is on welfare? Who is dependent? We need more linear thinking at this point. Oh, yes. Does that mean that we forget the intuition? Not at all. Does that mean we forget the oral tradition? Not at all. But it means then that while maintaining those traditions, we also must enhance other aspects of our personality. We want to look a bit at culture. What is culture? And we should ask this again. I admire Chancellor Williams very much, and I think the destruction of black civilization, of course, is a magnificent book, and I've said many times, though I think many people read it incorrectly, they read it as history, which it really is not, per se. It is, as he stated very clearly, a set of case studies, an analysis of African culture and of African history with the question in mind, in what way did these cultures or this history advance our interests in as a people, and in what way did this history fail us as a people as well? And we have to look at it that way. What were the problems represented by African cultures such that we permitted ourselves to be overrun by Europeans and we find ourselves in the situation that we find ourselves tonight? Understand? It's no insult for us to ask that question of ourselves. And it's no insult for us to look critically at African history and culture and to be critical of it. It is only through our being critical of our history and our culture that we can advance our interests as a people and survive as a people. Looking at the question, what is culture? Horton and Hunt said, from their life experiences, a group develops a set of rules and procedures for meeting their needs. The set of rules and procedures, together with a supporting set of ideas and values, is called a culture. To a great extent, you see, a culture involves a set of rules and a procedure for meeting needs. And this is the thing we have to keep in mind. You don't have a culture just to have a culture. And you don't claim a culture just because it's a culture or just because it's African. The ultimate thing that culture must do is solve problems. That's why people evolve a culture. That's why culture comes into existence as a way of what? Solving problems and meeting needs. That's why, at a certain point, when a culture no longer meets the needs of a people or solves the problem confronting a people, that culture must be transformed. There's nothing sacred about holding a culture in the face of, you know, new events and new changes. Unless, of course, you are free to do that if you're willing also to accept suicide or death. And you have that right to that choice. You know, I tell people, you know, we have the right to say, look, we're going to hold on to this culture even if it kills us. But we should be what? Very conscious of our decision. We should not be holding on to it out of a misunderstanding of what culture is supposed to do. Ultimately, culture is supposed to solve problems and to meet the needs of the people. And a culture then has to be measured against those standards. Does this culture meet our needs? Does it solve our problems? Chancellor Williams, in a sense, then looked at the African cultures, looked at African characteristics, and looked at them in terms of in what way did they meet our needs and in what way did they deal with the slave trade and colonialism and the other kind of things that happened to us as African people. And after going through that, then he set up what? The plan, which a lot of people don't read. Which is the whole point of what? That's the whole point of the book. Not the first part, but really the second part. Looking at our culture and our history critically He did. And looking at our situation and where we are today as a result of that history and of those cultures, he then draws out a map for a plan, a way for us to what? Get out of our situation and to restore African civilization and to restore African people. But it's at that point most people sort of move on to something else. Mm-mm. This is the place you must study. We're going to include that in our power studies, by the way, that plan along with some others. The sets and rules and procedures together with a supporting set of ideas. Cultures are not just ways people sing and dance and what they eat and how they dress and the rituals and so forth that they perform. These ways of behaving and dressing and so forth are based on sets of ideas and values. And ultimately, in a deeper sense, it's this set of ideals and values that lay the basis for culture. Kluckhorn and anthropologists indicated that culture and he defined culture as all the historically created designs for living, explicit and implicit, rational, irrational, and non-rational, which may exist at any given time as potential guides for the behavior of man, for the behavior of the people. In other words, culture creates designs as a result of its history for living and provides guides for its members, guides for behaving. As a set of the guides for designing, for guiding the behavior of its members, a culture provides standards of proper cognitive, emotional, and behavioral conduct. Culture provides a set of norms and concepts of what is to be expected to exist, why we expect them to exist. Though culture is a product of actual experience, culture is essentially ideological, meaning that it essentially exists in the mind, because culture ultimately is based on the sharing of beliefs and customs and expectations. We receive our culture as a result of, as a part of our social heritage. To the degree that the individual identifies or is at one with this culture, and to the degree to which the members of a culture identify with it, culture is represented in the minds of its people. In other words, we have to recognize deeply that culture cannot exist outside of ourselves. It only can exist in our minds and in our bodies as a people. And therefore, to a great extent, it is ideological more than it is physical, more than it is behavioral, more than it is just ways of dressing. Ultimately, a culture must be represented in the very minds of a people. And it is only through its representation as a mental entity that a people can identify with the culture. A culture is a way of thinking, a way of attending the world, of perceiving the world, of classifying and categorizing the world, of ordering the world, of processing information, and of evaluating the world. When we say then that the Europeans decultured us or distorted our culture, we are also saying then that the Europeans have distorted our modes of attending the world, our modes of experiencing the world, our modes of classifying and categorizing the world, our modes of processing information that comes from the world. So there's no little wonder then that we are having problems in what some people call education, particularly as it is European, Eurocentrically designed, that our children are perceived as having problems in thinking skills and math skills and science skills and so forth. Because ultimately, you see, culture provides you with a frame for thinking. It provides you with a structure for organizing information, for classifying information, for evaluating information, you see, for processing information. And when you distort a people's culture, then you distort their capacity to appropriately organize information and deal with it. And this is what has happened to us. This is the reason why I say again and again that the problem of education in terms of the problems our children have in schools are not education problems. They are political. They only express themselves as educational problems. The problems our children may have in paying attention, thinking so-called logically, categorizing, classifying, in terms of vocabulary and so forth, are really not academic problems. They are cultural problems, and they are the result of political interactions. Because in transforming our sense of who we are and what we are, and in transforming our culture, so was our thinking and so forth transformed as well. This is why ultimately the educational problems of our people will have to be solved in terms of cultural transformation, not just in terms of educational technique, you see. And this is what the whites try to lay on us. You know, we're going to discover finally that great reading technique. Children can learn almost in any way you teach them. But it's about more than technique. It must be a part of a total cultural structure. And the children must come with a cultural intentionality, because no technique is going to matter if they pay no mind, if they have no interest. You see, if their culture has given them little or no reason for learning what is to be taught, if what they're learning is really not relevant to their situation and their circumstances. And so we have to understand very much how culture itself structures the thought processes. Now, there are some of you who are saying, but there are those of us who knew nothing about African culture and we got all A's in school and so forth and so on. Remember this, though. We got these A's in school and we went through these schools at the price of alienation. The gentleman who's Carter G. Woodson wrote about the fact that it took him, 30 years to get over that Eurocentric education? What is he talking about? To a degree, without that African-centeredness, without that African sense of culture, without an African-centered intentionality that determined why he was learning and for what reason he was learning and how he was going to use his learning in the interests of African people, he adopted an alien culture, as many educated blacks have had to do. In adopting the alien culture and adopting the alien outlook and adopting alien values and so forth, they adopted then a thought framework, you see, that allowed so-called what? Success within the European academic system, you see. But the unfortunate thing about it is, once you adopt that structure and that mode and orientation of thinking, you can only work within it. And so you can keep your ability to think abstractly and logically and scientifically only if you work for us as a what? As a scientist. But you cannot take that thought and what? Outside of that structure and use it in your own interest. And this is the dilemma that many of those who so-called succeeded in this system have had to face, you see. I categorize and I classify, but I categorize and I classify in terms of European structures, and I find that I'm only comfortable in what? Working within those structures, and I can only what? Advance those structures. The European system has this economic system set up in such a way that when you try to use this structured kind of thought outside of the system, it won't pay you. Yeah, it will punish you. And often your own group has problems with it, because our group only pays preachers. But it would rarely pay anyone else that tries to operate in its interest. And so you get caught up in two worlds. socially, culture patterns, the ways in which its members relate to each other, interact with each other, perceive each other, and the ways they organize, develop, institutionalize, and apply their human potential in order to adapt to the conditions in which they live to satisfy psychological and social survival needs. Ultimately, as I said again and again, culture is about solving problems. But we're going to learn, as I've indicated before, solving problems in a cultural way, creating power in a cultural way, requires relating to each other in a particular sort of way, implies interacting with each other in a particular sort of way and perceiving each other in a particular sort of way. I've indicated under other circumstances that individuals do not have power. Power is the result of the nature of social relations between people. The way people choose to interact with each other makes power. If you don't believe it, you could go back a few years and see how little white boys could order grown black men around. Were they big enough to beat them? Were they big enough? Did they have enough power to knock them down? No, they didn't. But it was because those little white kids were in a, what, structured framework and had behind them, what, a set of structures and strategies that because white people had chosen to relate to each other in a particular way and interact with each other in a particular way and interact with us in a particular way, even a white child could come out and express power over black folk. But the power was not what? Inherent in the child. But it was inherent in the culture and inherent in how that culture was designed and structured. And it's out of this, and this is what I've told you before about an economic system. An economic system is not the mere existence of money. Economic systems existed prior to money. Money as an instrument of economy has come late in the...
A man, the big payback, got to get back. I need some get back.
During Reconstruction, we held every major position you can imagine.
That's right.
From the 41st Congress to the 56th Congress, we were involved in every one of the congressional systems or the congressional process from that 41st to the 56th.
Yeah.
We were mayors. We were judges.
Right.
We were sheriffs.
Right.
We were senators. We were congressmen, and even B.K. Bruce of the Treasury Department, a black man, had his signature on all paper money in the United States of America, so it made no difference that a redneck camel breath, snuff-dipping, tobacco-chewing, straw-chewing, beer-belly, overall-wearing, peckerwood, hated niggas, every cracker in order to buy anything had to spend money with a black man's signature during Reconstruction on the paper money. But when white folks got tired of niggas being in political positions of authority over them, they lined up armed white men at the door of Congress. Bishop Henry McNeil Turner of the AME Church,
that's right,
armed guards stood at the door of Congress and would not permit Bishop Henry McNeil Turner, a black elected public official and a congressman, to enter the halls of Congress. They stood at the door of the mayor's office. They lined armed guards up at the sheriff's office, a black sheriff elected to be the sheriff of the town. But crackers stood at the door with their guns and said, no more nigger sheriffs in this town. And brought another big beer-bellied peckerwood with overalls on, who was the new sheriff, Big Bubba. And they said, nigger, Big Bubba's the sheriff here in town now. No more nigger sheriff. And if you don't get away from here, we're going to arrest you. Judges were unseated.
That's right.
Senators were unseated. and Knight Riders, Ku Klux Klan, and disgruntled, angry, egotistical white men decided that it was a period that had to be stopped, that blacks were infringing on the rights of white people. Does it sound familiar? They're talking about the angry white male today. And under charges of exaggerated corruption, in politics, the poor black man was swept from political positions. It looked like a period of political prosperity. But when the white man got tired of black people being in these political positions, he drove us from these political positions. But you're running all over the place, ready to vote. Some of you with your dreadlocks, you're ready to vote. Some of you with an African name as long as North Avenue, you're ready to vote, trying to decide which cracker you're going to vote for. And it's not even the popular vote that determines who the president is going to be. It's the Electoral College vote that determines who the president is going to be. And you're going to go behind a glorified shower curtain pulling a lever, trying to decide which one of these suckers you're going to vote for. It's impossible to defend black law and not break white law. Impossible to defend white law and not break black law. The two are diametrically opposed, 180 degrees different from each other. You cannot seek freedom and independence for black people and talk integration talk with white folks. You cannot talk out of both sides of your mouth. It's impossible to do that. You cannot say we must get away from the color game and the skin game when you are black and your color and your melanin is what marks you and hooks you with the universe and links you with the spiritual, divine, universal, and cosmological order of things. You cannot say we must get away from that and say that you are defending divine law and defending black law. We, brothers and sisters, must understand the very nature in which God has created us. We are righteous by nature. We are other than righteous by circumstance. It is 400 years in specific and 6,000 years in general under the white man that has put us in this condition. 400 years in specific and 6,000 years in general that causes us to break black law today. You can't say you're defending black law when you will eat anything. Put anything in your body. Eat whatever you saw the peckerwood eat. Ham hocks might be good for the white man. Pork chops and pig feet might be good for the white man. A whole lot of meat might be good for the white man. But it's not good for your delicate system. You cannot defend white law and not offend and break black law at the same time. Remember, your law is not what is written on paper, but it is the very nature in which God has created you. And I'm happy that they asked me to say a word, at least, on black law. Let's go further with the subject that was given to me here tonight, dealing with revolution and dealing with war coming in America, and what the topic theme is to reflect and focus on guidelines for war. Make no mistake about it, brothers and sisters, war is coming in this country.
Yes, sir.
War is coming in this country on an escalated level. We're already in a war. We may not be at war, but we're definitely in a war. And the white man is waging warfare against us in every field, in every discipline, on every plane.
Yes,
it makes no difference if you're a basketball nigger, the white man is waging war against basketball niggas. A football one, a baseball one, an actor on the big movie screen or the small television screen, it makes no difference. The white man is waging war.
Yes,
if you work as a janitor or a maintenance engineer on the job, the white man is waging war. He's cutting the food stamps. He's waging war. He's cutting affirmative action. He's waging war. Section 8 entitlements. He's waging war. The attack on the black student who cannot finance an education, the white man is waging war. He is working to maintain white supremacy. And all over America, they are now beginning to kill us at an alarming rate. Shoot us 25 times, shoot us 10 times, shoot us 8 times. Apply the chokehold, and then when the cop, after witnesses have seen it all over the community, when the cop goes before the courts of the criminal justice system of white America, they let him go scot-free. The white man is waging war.
Right.
Mark Furman says the policeman, meaning the white man,